So Sri Aurobindo began with the human aspiration and with the affirmations of Vedanta, confirming that existence is a divine exploration of its own being in the cosmos, and always humanity representing something inherent in the divine consciousness is seeking its ultimate principle, God, light, freedom, immortality, and thus regards all problems which are presented to it in its path of development as opportunities to discover a secret harmony at their base. All problems are problems of harmony. And thus, if we're going to have harmony, we have to have a deep look at the apparent antinomy between our spiritual goal and our earthly existence. And in the second chapter, where he begins dealing with the two negations, the first, the materialist denial, we see that the insistence on either pole of existence, excluding the other, leaves the human spirit unsatisfied. That if we look at the quest that materialism has to ground itself in the experience of the senses and to extend its knowledge out from there, it is led inevitably to the boundaries of what is unknown and asks to push beyond it. And as we push beyond these areas, which are fields of temporary ignorance, we gain access to deeper and deeper knowledge. And that's the saving grace in materialism. It wipes away half errors and pushes towards a knowledge that is surely based. The other negation, the spiritual, is more problematic, Sri Aurobindo notes, even in that chapter, because it is more nihilistic in its refusal. And so to that chapter we come tonight. Chapter 3, the two negations, two, the refusal of the ascetic. All this is the Brahman. This self is the Brahman, and the self is fourfold. Beyond relation, featureless, unthinkable, in which all is still. The Mandukya Upanishad, verses 2 and 7. He's chosen these verses from the Mandukya because they not only get to the pith of his argument, but the Mandukya is often associated with the ascetic tradition, the sannyasa tradition of India, which is the longest held in all Hinduism, the school founded by Shankara. And indeed, the commentary on the Mandukya by Gaudapada, who is supposed to be Shankara's teacher, his mentor, is that which is considered to be stellar and a standard by which all of the commentaries are measured. All this is the Brahman, though, says this very Upanishad, which is supposed to be world-negating, according to the Advaita Vedanta, of whom Gaudapada was an originator, a founder. And not only is all this Brahman, all the wide universe, but it goes on to say that this self is the Brahman. So the width, the breadth of the universe, the colossal cosmos, as it were, and the innate self, the subjective aspect, so objective and subjective poles of reality, are one and the same thing. And this self is fourfold because it is many-tiered. It goes on, as you know, because you've read this Upanishad, to describe the material base, the creative base, that realm of existence where all is in a superconscient sleep, and then a fourth, a turiya, a state which is all-comprehending, in which all of these other states of existence are placed, not in a spatial sense, but in a real sense. So those are the four states of existence. But the Upanishad goes on to say, a few verses later, beyond relation, featureless, unthinkable, in which all is still. So this is that aspect of reality which the ascetic is prone to arrive at through the practice of his inner discipline, his tapasya. It is world excluding, it is self affirming, capital S in the self. The Mandukya, by the way, is part of the Atharva Veda. Interesting, because in the Rig Veda, there are some rishis whose names are associated with this, Mandukya, the frog-like, possibly because when the rishis drank the soma, the immortalizing elixir, which lifted their consciousness into oneness with what is beyond, they would croak like frogs. That's how the Veda describes them. So apparently when you drank that, it would have an effect on your vocal cords and you would croak like a frog. I would love to hear that. It would be music to these old ears. So, now to Sri Aurobindo's own words. And still there is a beyond. Because in the last chapter, he's been describing the cosmic knowledge in its various grades. And now he comes to pose to us a still vaster question, if we could put it that way. For on the other side of the cosmic consciousness, there is, attainable to us, a consciousness yet more transcendent. Transcendent not only of the ego, but of the cosmos itself, against which the universe seems to stand out like a petty picture against an immeasurable background. That supports the universal activity, or perhaps only tolerates it. It embraces life with its vastness, or else rejects it from its infinitude. So we live in a personal consciousness, but Sri Aurobindo has described to us that as we push beyond the boundaries of ego knowledge, we can break into the breadth of a cosmic awareness. This cosmic consciousness explodes us out of our fixity in this personhood. But beyond that is something which is transcendent. Transcendence, transcendere in the Latin, means to cross a boundary. So this is described as a reality beyond the cosmos. So if there is a transversal line separating the transcendent above and the cosmos below, the fixity of the individual as a formed becoming lies within the cosmic. So that which is transcendent to it is a different sort of transcendence than we met when we simply enlarged our awareness to that of the universal stature. And against that transcendence, the cosmos seems like a petty picture. Now, this goes back to the Bhagavad Gita and its description of the spiritual ether. When Krishna is describing to Arjuna what is the nature of Brahman, what is the nature of that reality, he says you have to see it in a spatial sense, because it's the only way that the mind can relate to it. But using spatial terms is imperfect. But something that is all-containing, that is intimate within you, and yet also beyond you, just as the space in this room is both intimate to us, we move and experience it, and yet, if we were not here, it would still exist. It would still be there. In this way, the mind can form a kind of image, a concept, which is analogous to that which we cannot communicate by word. And that transcendent, he says, supports the universal activity, or perhaps only tolerates it. Embraces life, or else rejects it. So, continuing to the next paragraph, if the materialist is justified from his point of view in insisting on matter as reality, the relative world as the sole thing of which we can in some sort be sure, and the beyond as wholly unknowable, if not indeed non-existent, a dream of the mind, an abstraction of thought, divorcing itself from reality, so also is the sannyasin, enamored of that beyond, justified from his point of view in insisting on pure spirit as the reality, the one thing free from change, birth, death, and the relative as a creation of the mind and the senses, a dream, an abstraction in the contrary sense of mentality withdrawing from the pure and eternal knowledge. Again, we're left with this dilemma. Which side do you wish to place yourself on? The materialist can say, my senses don't extend that far, and therefore I have no right to say anything about that which I cannot touch. It's a hallucination. It's a dream. What you're thinking about is not justified. But to the sannyasin who has this experience of what transcends, of what is beyond the cosmos, then to that person, to look at the limitations of the relative world is to be drawn into an impure and ephemeral knowledge and away from what is pure and eternal. Why would he do that? Because his spiritual experience affirms that which is timeless, that which is immobile, that which is pure and unmoving. And look at this phenomenal existence. Ever changing, never secure, you can't trust anything. So why would you believe that to be true when your experience tells you that that, capital T, is true? So, on to this next paragraph then. What justification of logic or of experience can be asserted in support of the one extreme which cannot be met by an equally cogent logic and an equally valid experience at the other end? The world of matter is affirmed by the experience of the physical senses, which, because they are themselves unable to perceive anything immaterial or not organized as gross matter, would persuade us that the suprasensible is the unreal. This vulgar or rustic error of our corporeal organs does not gain in validity by being promoted into the domain of philosophical reasoning. Obviously, their pretension is unfounded. Even in the world of matter, there are existences of which the physical senses are incapable of taking cognizance. Well, that is more apparent now than ever, because physics has pushed us, biology has pushed us into realms which the senses previously could not gauge, and has helped develop theories to account for phenomena that can't even yet be measured, but can only be suspected. That may not be a sure knowledge, but it promises us that there is something unknown to us which we have yet to come into contact with, and which cannot be explained by the mere reach of the five senses available to us, and the sixth, the mind which organizes the data from those five senses. And continuing, he says, yet the denial of the supersensible, that means to say the supersensible is that which is beyond the senses, beyond the measure of the physical senses, as necessarily an illusion or a hallucination, depends on this constant sensuous association of the real with the materially perceptible, which is itself a hallucination. Assuming throughout what it seeks to establish, it has the vice of the argument in a circle and can have no validity for an impartial reasoning. In other words, if you set the game up so that the way you ask the question always gives you the same answer, then you go round and round and round. So, shall we try another paragraph? Not only are there physical realities which are supersensible, but if evidence and experience are at all a test of truth, there are also senses which are supraphysical and can not only take cognizance of the realities of the material world without the aid of the corporeal sense organs, but can bring us into contact with other realities, supraphysical and belonging to another world, included, that is to say, in an organization of conscious experiences that are dependent on some other principle than the gross matter of which our suns and earths seem to be made. So again, you could say that this is another reference to the Sankhian chain of nature, the various levels of becoming, each connected to the other. But you might also note that more powerfully, this is a reflection of his own personal experience encoded here into this paragraph. You see that footnote 2. Sukshma indriyas, subtle organs existing in the subtle body, sukshma deha, and the means of subtle vision and experience, sukshma drishti. There is no instance of this term, sukshma indriyas, in the Monier-Williams massive Sanskrit dictionary, Sanskrit-English dictionary, but there is the use of the term in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in Book 3, Chapter 27, and I think the verse is 14. There is the usage of the term there. And I haven't found the usage anywhere else. I thought I would encounter it again if I went through the old books that I have on the Sankhya, and I couldn't locate it there. But Sri Aurobindo began using this term with some frequency in his own record of yoga, starting from at least around 1912. And of course it refers exactly as he says, to senses which are above the physical, or you might say behind the physical, so they are subtle senses through which one can appertain other worlds not connected to the physical, and can thus gain experience of them. So, if you go and read his record of yoga, you'll find these instances. By the way, when he mentions sukshma indriya here, it's the only instance in the Life Divine that I can find where he has made this reference. There is no other. We'll talk a good deal about coursing through those worlds and exploring them, but he's not going to use this term again. Now, to stay with this for a moment, the sukshma deha, the subtle body, will also be called the real body in a sense, because it is seen and taken that this gross material body, the stula deha, is an extension of it into the finalities of physical space and time. But it exists prior to that in this subtle sphere. And so the senses, including sukshma drishti, that inner sight, that subtle sight or telepathic perception, is native to that. But just as that immortal, subtle body, when transposed into this world of physicality, becomes mortal, capable of disintegration, so too the senses, when they apply themselves to gross physical data, become imperfect. So in their own right, in subtle spheres, their vision, their tact, the various powers that they have are vaster and more valid. They bring you surer knowledge. We'll see how this gains importance to Sri Aurobindo as we continue the argument. Let's pause for a moment and look at another section of this sentence. These senses can bring us into contact with other realities, supraphysical and belonging to another world, included, that is to say, in an organization of conscious experiences that are dependent on some other principle than the gross matter. So what is this other principle that finally organizes and presents itself as this cosmos? He doesn't answer the question here, but he's suggesting that the ordering of the worlds is from above, not below. So matter cannot be the author of the universe. It is a final result of the creative urge, not its originating point. One final point about the sukshma deha, and then I promise to leave it alone for a moment. The subtle physical is that which contains within it all those various centers of consciousness that we call the chakras, whether there are five or six or nine. Abhinavagupta, Goraksha referred to nine, sort of matching the nine-gated city of the Upanishads. Various centrations of conscious power at different levels of our being, which connect all the worlds from the topmost to the bottommost. It all occurs in that inner body, which then extrapolates itself out to the universe. One other note, As we've seen, the individual is simply an expressive power at a limited level of what is universal. Our focus is less, but we are one with the universe. So, in that way also, the subtle worlds are arranged in the same manner as the subtle body in our own selves. So as the world goes, so go we. If we find the consciousness in ourselves to open a power at a certain level, that can have cosmic consequence because the individual is part of the cosmos. Bear that in mind as we go forward. I'm giving you lots of baggage to carry. Anybody want a little red wagon? Next paragraph. Constantly asserted by human experience and belief since the origins of thought, this truth, now that the necessity of an exclusive preoccupation with the secrets of the material world no longer exists, begins to be justified by newborn forms of scientific research. The increasing evidences, of which only the most obvious and outward, are established under the name of telepathy with its cognate phenomena, cannot long be resisted except by minds shut up in the brilliant shell of the past, by intellects limited, in spite of their acuteness, through the limitation of their field of experience and inquiry, or by those who confuse enlightenment and reason with the faithful repetition of the formulas left to us from a bygone century and the jealous conservation of dead or dying intellectual dogmas. Well, I think he's referring to, at that time, the promising work in the field of psychology by Frederick Myers, later by William James and Carl Jung, etc. But we have to note that it seems to have been arrested in its advance, although we do have, again, the transpersonal school of psychology following upon Abraham Maslow. And for those things, we can be grateful. I should also like to mention psychosynthesis as a particularly interesting school in modern psychology. But he's commenting about the limitations of 19th century science, especially science as it had posed itself in the field of psychology. He was hoping that psychology would make the breakthrough and establish verifiable methods which would convince the other sciences of the reality of these superphysical realms that the yogin can gain access to. So far, we can establish that these states are attainable, but that they refer to metaphysically valid regions of reality beyond the material is something we have yet to clinch. It is true, continuing with the next paragraph, that the glimpse of superphysical realities acquired by methodical research has been imperfect and is yet ill-affirmed, for the methods used are still crude and defective. But these rediscovered subtle senses have at least been found to be true witnesses to physical facts beyond the range of the corporeal organs. There is no justification, then, for scouting them as false witnesses when they testify to superphysical facts beyond the domain of the material organization of consciousness. Like all evidence, like the evidence of the physical senses themselves, their testimony has to be controlled, scrutinized, and arranged by the reason, rightly translated and rightly related, and their field, laws, and processes determined. But the truth of great ranges of experience, whose objects exist in a more subtle substance and are perceived by more subtle instruments than those of gross physical matter, claims in the end the same validity as the truth of the material universe. The worlds beyond exist. They have their universal rhythm, their grand lines and formations, their self-existent laws and mighty energies, their just and luminous means of knowledge. And here, on our physical existence and in our physical body, they exercise their influences. Here also, they organize their means of manifestation and commission their messengers and their witnesses. So this is an important paragraph. He's stated a couple of things impliedly which deserve our attention. First, in the sentence that begins, there is no justification. When they testify to supraphysical facts beyond the domain of the material organization of consciousness, he is saying that the physical means by which we would wish to measure have no validity there, and the only means by which we can ascertain their validity is through the instrument of consciousness. And who is it that wields the consciousness but the person inquiring? How does he do that? But through his experience, through his growing experience and realization of realities and powers. So consciousness will be the key element of his epistemology, of his theory of knowledge. And note at the bottom, and here on our physical existence, in our physical body, they exercise their influences. These worlds exist. And not only can we, through the assay of our conscious being into those realms, by projecting ourselves, by traveling there, come to meet and know those dimensions of reality, but we can feel their influence upon us here. The more conscious we grow, the more we feel the impact of these supraphysical worlds. Now that suggests that the things that happen here on Earth are not utterly determined by physical realities, that these physical realities are themselves impregnated by forces and powers and realities superior to them. And these planes above the physical, just to enumerate them again, the world of life, prana, the world of mind, manas, the supermind, vijnana, and above that, the worlds of ananda, delight, conscious power, chit, tapas, sheer existence, sat, all expressive affirmatively of the reality of the supreme existence. So this paragraph is key in Sri Aurobindo's justification of how we can link the world of matter to the truth of spirit. If this bridge is not made, then the philosophy fails. If we make this bridge and consciousness is the bridge, then this philosophy sails. Onwards. But the worlds are only frames for our experience, the senses only instruments of experience and conveniences. It's a wonderful sentence. Consciousness is the great underlying fact, the universal witness for whom the world is a field, the senses instrument. So something supports and views all of these planes of existence that we just enumerated. They are frames. They are like stages upon which we move and live. And who is the audience? There's only one being in the audience, the divine consciousness. We are multiplications of that only existence. which is aware of itself. That consciousness supports the universe. The senses merely register contact of various kinds within that universe, which the consciousness supports and holds up. Continuing, to that witness, the worlds and their objects appeal for their reality and for the one world or the many, for the physical equally with the supraphysical, we have no other evidence that they exist. Because even for us to say that the physical world exists is an act of consciousness. It has been argued that this is no relation peculiar to the constitution of humanity and its outlook upon an objective world, but the very nature of existence itself. All phenomenal existence consists of an observing consciousness and an active objectivity, and the action cannot proceed without the witness, because the universe exists only in or for the consciousness that observes and has no independent reality. Again, where have you heard this? Well, Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha, the conscious person. Prakriti, the play of nature, that which produces all of that. But without the active consent and witnessing power of consciousness, none of this moves. They seem to be two principles, but they too, isn't it, are deeply connected. In fact, if they are not, we are left with the dilemma with which we began this book. How do you unite matter and spirit? Again, we're talking about Purusha and Prakriti. It has been argued in reply that the material universe enjoys an eternal self-existence. This is the view of materialism. It was here before life and mind made their appearance. It will survive after they have disappeared and no longer trouble with their transient strivings and limited thoughts the eternal and inconscient rhythm of the suns. The difference, so metaphysical in appearance, is yet of the utmost practical import, for it determines the whole outlook of man upon life. The goal that he shall assign for his efforts and the field in which he shall circumscribe his energies. For it raises the question of the reality of cosmic existence, and more important still, the question of the value of human life. So these two are in antinomy. So is the cosmos real? And what can we say positively about the nature of human life? If we push the materialist conclusion far enough, we arrive at an insignificance and unreality in the life of the individual and the race, which leaves us logically the option between either a feverish effort of the individual to snatch what he may from a transient existence, to live his life, as it is said, or a dispassionate and objectless service of the race and the individual, knowing well that the latter is a transient fiction of the nervous mentality and the former only a little more long-lived collective form of the same regular nervous spasm of matter. So that's where materialism leaves us. Either we get what we can, or we do our perfunctory duty in the world, knowing that it has no ultimate value, because matter rises and falls, and from dust we come and to dust we go. We work or enjoy under the impulsion of a material energy which deceives us with the brief delusion of life, or with the nobler delusion of an ethical aim and a mental consummation. Materialism, like spiritual monism, arrives at a maya that is and yet is not. Is, for it is present and compelling. Is not, for it is phenomenal and transitory in its works. So it's our immediate experience, but our experience doesn't last, it fades. Light comes, light goes. Love comes, love goes. Joy comes, joy goes. At the other end, if we stress too much the unreality of the objective world, we arrive by a different road at similar but still more trenchant conclusions. The fictitious character of the individual ego, the unreality and purposelessness of human existence, the return into the non-being or the relationless absolute as the sole rational escape from the meaningless tangle of phenomenal life. So this is the mutual exclusion, and what happens from each. If materialism insists rigidly, then life and world are ultimately without meaning. If we insist on the spiritual monism, then world is purposeless. By definition, non-being or absolute being is the only thing for us. Why should we bother at all with the relative? Back up to the top of the paragraph. And the sentence before that. The value of human life. The suggestion is that the soul will become a central issue in our measuring of the cosmos. That for us to establish the reality of cosmic existence and meaning in it, that spiritual reality which is at our core must come to front and center. Because it is that, ultimately, which will link cosmos to the transcendent. That source above is in us, and we are the conscious agent by which the cosmos discovers its own secret nature and refreshes itself. Trying to see. Are brave enough for a bit more? Good. So, the next paragraph. And yet the question cannot be solved by logic, arguing on the data of our ordinary physical existence. For in those data, there is always a hiatus of experience which renders all argument inconclusive. We have normally neither any definitive experience of a cosmic mind or supermind not bound up with the life of the individual body, nor, on the other hand, any firm limit of experience which would justify us in supposing that our subjective self really depends upon the physical frame and can neither survive it nor enlarge itself beyond the individual body. So, either side of the argument can't be resolved through the use of reason. That's not going to be the way we do it. Here we go. Only by an extension of the field of our consciousness or an unhoped-for increase in our instruments of knowledge can the ancient quarrel be decided. Well, you know where he's going to lean. Consciousness only can resolve the issue. Because how can we build instruments of knowledge which are going to do the job for consciousness? Rather, he will prefer the extension of the field of our awareness. So we move on then. That's a simple paragraph, right? Mm-hmm. The extension of our consciousness to be satisfying must necessarily be an inner enlargement from the individual into the cosmic existence. For the witness, if he exists, is not the individual embodied mind born in the world, but that cosmic consciousness embracing the universe and appearing as an immanent intelligence in all its works, to which either world subsists eternally and really as its own active existence, or else from which it is born and into which it disappears by an act of knowledge or by an act of conscious power. Not organized mind, but that which, calm and eternal, broods equally in the living earth and the living human body, and to which mind and senses are dispensable instruments, is the witness of cosmic existence and its Lord. So he has described the cosmic self. And that again was an easy paragraph. Onwards. The possibility of a cosmic consciousness in humanity is coming slowly to be admitted in modern psychology, like the possibility of more elastic instruments of knowledge, although still classified, even when its value and power are admitted, as a hallucination. So, of course, the great book at the turn of the century was Cosmic Consciousness by Richard Bucky, and this is a clear reference to it. In the psychology of the East, it has always been recognized as a reality and the aim of our subjective progress. The essence of the passage over to this goal is the exceeding of the limits imposed on us by the ego sense, and at least a partaking, at most an identification, with the self-knowledge which broods secret in all life and in all that seems to us inanimate. Well, early in India's spiritual history, of course, the Upanishads record this very experience and notion. Later, Sankhya Yoga maps and discusses these areas of consciousness, and if one attains certain regions and styles of awareness, because that is, after all, what consciousness does, it maps and forms and reshapes itself, then one could identify with the cosmos as a whole and affect cosmic change, move things at a distance, understand things, reveal powers, affect world dominion, if one so wished. I think actually that might be a good place to conclude for the evening. What do you think? And we'll save the balance of the chapter for next time. We can by no means finish tonight anyway, so I think that's where we'll leave it, and next week we'll begin with the sentence, entering into that consciousness, we may continue to dwell like it upon universal existence. Well, do you have comments or questions from this earlier portion?
Well, I always have a question, but there's a lot that comes up in this for me. But, you know, people that are in the denial of spirit claim when they encounter someone who has super sensible sort of experiences that it's something created out of our own need for something beyond the known. Mm-hmm. To comfort us and that kind of thing. So it almost seems like as various people enlarge themselves, self-enlargement, and discover these areas, if they're taught how and getting that, and then report back
mm-hmm.
that they are continually claimed as these created experience within the psyche that don't go beyond that into the other worlds. And so
mm-hmm.
how will we break the news to the rest of the world that it, how much will it take? I mean, at what point does does this create something that is accepted?
Mm-hmm.
Does there have to be, as Jung said, a mass consciousness, which mm-hmm. then becomes, you know, I forgot the word he used, but reaches a point of everybody
mm-hmm.
acknowledges it, or it becomes available to everybody, like the Hundredth Monkey concept,
mm-hmm.
or what?
Well, I think it's not quite as hopeless as that. I think that we have made actually pretty dynamic and conclusive strides in recent decades, because funding has come forward to actually measure states of meditation and to recognize that we can deliberately change our consciousness, change the actual brain waves which occupy our head at any time, and that in those states we can affect the terms of our health by lowering our blood pressure, by reducing stress in the being, and exhibiting more buoyancy in meeting problems in life, etc., and yet still be fresh and energetic and interested in the world. So that we can do all that has impressed people in biological and psychological sciences. And so that is part of what Sri Aurobindo described in earlier pages as the press of science beyond the known into the unknown. So as long as we're moving forward and doing good research and able to validate our experience and prove that consciousness can have an impact upon matter, and not only does matter have an impact upon consciousness, that we can change deliberately the valuations of our lives, tends to argue that consciousness is at least equivalent with matter. It argues towards that. The big question, of course, is unresolved to this day. The split between what is supposedly spirit and what is matter has not yet been closed. No. It's the big problem in philosophy. It's the big problem in psychological science. Because can one ever say that a person's experience is not mere mood making, so to say? And not reflective of higher realities. Until we can develop criteria of consciousness which permit us to range into those supraphysical fields and bring back data which are verifiable according to the laws of rationality, maybe not according to the laws of physical science, but you know, can appertain to that, I don't think that we'll have won the day. We must establish that.
Well, isn't that sort of what happened to psychology in the early last century when they began to decide to quantify all the interesting things that were coming out of the Blavatsky movement and all that stuff? They began to, psychology drifted into this real hardcore, and then it got into...
Well, I think the movement with Blavatsky and even Frederick Myers and some of those people led us into a blind alley where we came out with a black eye, you know, because I don't think their experiments were true and scientifically repeatable, and might even have had fraud, frankly, associated with them, and that's unfortunate. You know, if we're too eager to establish these truths and make naive mistakes, I think it only redounds against us. So we need to do careful science and move forward as we can. The problem with these things is that they're underfunded. You know, we're out there trying to solve much larger problems right now, and even larger questions than this may be before us. Like, let's just keep the globe going. Let's just keep everything alive that's here. Once
Right.
we've assured that, we can move forward, you know.
Well, perhaps this existence is not necessarily to prove to everyone here what we experience in the worlds beyond, but to come in here, develop the potential, and then leave.
I'm not interested in leaving, and I'm not sure that our goal is to convince the skeptical that our experiences are real. That's interesting, and I think that we should do that. Fundamentally, you've seen Sri Aurobindo arrive at a point where he's arguing that the best epistemology is that which is based on conscious experience. And that is what leads us beyond the ego into the cosmic, and beyond the cosmic into the transcendence. And that is what liberates. But at no point has he been willing to surrender the physical world in preference to that. Now, we'll complete this argument next week. Let's look forward to that, shall we?
Okay. Enough said.
Other notes or questions? And remember that I don't have my glasses on, so I can't really see
You were elaborating on page 23, the last paragraph, where it raises the question of reality of cosmic existence and, more important still, the question of the value of human life. You were talking about, you know, the soul being central and how it has to come out the front and center. It links the cosmos to the transcendent. We are the conscious agent by which the transcendent, you'd mentioned, like, we are the conscious agent by which that discovers itself and is like replenished or refreshed. I don't remember, I mean, you were just speaking. What was it that you were saying about, like, we're the conscious agent by which it's like refreshed? I mean, in my mind, it's, you know,
Because I think
the
it,
above below and.
in a way, you can say, put it this way, that the soul which has become conscious of itself and is no longer identified with the ego as its point of individuation, but knows itself to be a conscious person in the great person consciousness, that being connects to the cosmos in a way that leads the world forwards. It is when we become aware of the inner powers within ourselves. First, by knowing what that sheer consciousness is in us, it is us. It is that. That is our central ground. And then we gather together these various instruments of our movement through nature, currently in the form of the human, with these nine centers of consciousness, let's say. And through that, we vivify, we pour life into the world. Because we charm the world when we live from the soul. We beatify existence when we recover our own immortality. If we identify only with the outer shell of our being, which is evanescent, which is formed and destroyed, then what hope can there be if we don't find what we really are inside? That waits for another inning. So it is self-knowledge, if you want to put it that way, that liberates the individual and empowers the individual to liberate the cosmos. But there are steps in between. The conscious individual has to have an impact upon the life of the community, the life of the society. Not so much that it spends all of its energy, dispenses all of its energy in that, but it should have a meaningful interface with society. Without exhausting itself and without demanding of society that it change to an extent it cannot achieve. Do you see what I mean? It is difficult for an individual to go through the rapid revolution that a change of consciousness means. It is always more difficult for a society to change. It moves at what seems to the individual to be a glacial pace. But we begin with ourselves. That's our first work. This is our given mission. And then we reach out so far as it is creative. We share. We give. We serve. But we do it in concert with the divine will, because the divine also demands that our consciousness continue to grow. And if we give all that we are with a certain level of attainment and are satisfied only with that, we never get beyond. We simply exhaust the available energies where we might have grown still farther and be able to give still more from a greater height. So you can't undergo an act of self-immolation prematurely. Do you see what I mean? All right. So we'll end for tonight and go contemplate this in meditation. Thanks for listening. Namaste. Jai Ma.